iHeart Podcasts.
Guess what, Gabe?
What's that, Mango?
So I read this great story in Scientific American. It's called Saving California Condors with a Chisel and Hand Puppets. So it has to be one of the greatest titles I've read in a while. But are you familiar with these birds?
I know they're huge birds and I think they're endangered too, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. So they were close to extinction a few decades ago. I think their count was down to just over 20 birds in the early 80s. And that's actually when the Oregon Zoo stepped in. So one of the strange things about condor eggs is that sometimes the chicks aren't actually strong enough to break out of the shells. So the caretakers at the zoo, like, they stand by ready with a chisel to help them break out. And in fact, it worked so well that the zoo has now raised more than 70 condor chicks.
Well, that's awesome. But what do they do then? Do they release them into the wild?
Yeah, but if the chicks are raised in captivity without their parents, the minders have to be really careful about how they feed them because, you know, they don't want these birds to be too trusting of humans. So they have these hand puppets made to look like condors, and that's what they use to feed the little hatchlings. But reading that story made me think, you know, maybe it's time to do an episode on some of the world's largest birds and also all the secrets we definitely don't know about them. So let's dive in. Hey there, podcast listeners. Welcome to Part-Time Genius. I'm Mangesh Shetigler, and my good pal Will Pearson's on vacation today. But I'm so thrilled because I get to hang out with the wonderful Gabe Lussier, who's on the line with me. Hey, Gabe, how's it going?
Hey, it's going well. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, Gabe. And on the other side of the soundproof glass, carving into the biggest, fattest turkey I've seen this side of Thanksgiving, that's our friend and producer, Tristan McNeil. And I've got to say, while Tristan's on theme as usual, it does feel a little weird to watch him chow down on a bird while we're also talking about birds.
Yeah, I mean, I was hoping we'd get to see Tristan in like a big bird costume today, or maybe find out that he's secretly been taking falconry classes or something.
But. Well, we should put that in the suggestion box for next time, I think. But today's episode is all about the world's largest birds.
Yeah, that's right. We scoured the skies to find the most oversized birds out there, and now it's time to spill all their juicy secrets, like how have large birds adapted for survival and how they got so big in the first place. But, you know, Mango, I'm curious, where do you want to start with this one?
So I thought I'd kick things off with a nice feel-good story about one of the world's largest birds, which is the wandering albatross. And this species of albatross is big by just about any measure. Their bodies are about 3.5 feet from bill to tail. They weigh 20-some pounds on average. But without a doubt, their biggest and most striking feature has to be their enormous wingspan. Because, you know, I'm sure you probably know this, wandering albatrosses have the largest wingspan of any living bird. It's between 11 and 12 feet from tip to tip. And with wings that big, you know, these birds are obviously built for flight. They've actually been known to circumnavigate the Southern Ocean up to 3 times in a single year. And one bird in particular is known to have traveled nearly 4,000 miles in just 12 days.
Which is so impressive, of course, but like, what's their secret for covering that kind of distance? Because you have to think that flapping a pair of 12-foot wings must take an awful lot of energy.
Yeah, there's really no way an albatross could do that by flapping. Like, they'd be exhausted within an hour, tops. Instead, albatrosses actually use this method called dynamic soaring, and it allows them to glide across these incredible distances without needing to flap their wings. And this works because the birds have this special tendon in each of their shoulders that helps lock their wings into place. It's kind of a birdie cruise control. And once their wings are locked into position, albatrosses simply glide along, swooping as needed to catch the wind and gradually rise back up.
That's really cool. But, I mean, they never have to stop and take a rest or anything?
No, not really. I mean, it's hard to walk on land with that 12-foot wingspan. So apart from mating season, wandering albatrosses tend to stick to the air as much as possible. And there is one exception, though. If an albatross goes crazy and just eats way too many fish, they might need to take a break and float on top of the water for a while, you know, until they've digested it.
Oh, well, that's pretty cute. But I think you said you had a feel-good story about albatrosses? Like, what exactly does that mean?
Yeah, that's right. And it's actually about one albatross in particular. Her name is Wisdom, and as of this year, she's going to be 67 years old, which makes her the world's oldest known wild bird. She was born sometime in 1951, but this biologist started tracking her in 1956. And since then, Wisdom has managed to rack up somewhere between 2 to 3 million miles in flying time, which is the equivalent of about 4 to 6 trips to the moon and back.
Gosh, that's incredible. Or at least I think it's incredible. I mean, I actually don't know how long albatrosses typically lived. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the species, but they'll live, I guess, 40 to 50 years if they're lucky. Albatrosses are one of those rare species of birds and wild animals in general, I guess, that sometimes live long enough to die of old age.
Well, I guess that's, you know, one of the perks of that wandering lifestyle, right? Because, I mean, if you're constantly on the move, flying over an ocean, you pretty much have an unlimited food supply right there below you, and most predators wouldn't be able to keep up with you anyway.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And amazingly, the biggest threats to albatrosses are natural disasters. And also, I guess, the consumption of plastic, both of which Wisdom has managed to avoid for almost 7 decades now. But perhaps the most interesting thing to me was that she's birthed and raised over 40 chicks over her long lifetime. And that includes her most recent one, which was hatched just this spring.
I've always thought albatrosses were really cool, you know, partially because of all the old sea myths around them and also that epic Coleridge poem. But, you know, nowadays they mostly make the news, you know, and there's like YouTube videos and stuff that just kind of make fun of how silly they look when they're trying to walk on land. It's actually kind of a bummer.
I mean, even the name albatross, which is pretty awkward in its own right, like it was apparently just taken from words used to describe other seabirds. So it comes from algatas, which was, I guess, this Arabic word for a sea eagle. And then that was adapted into a Spanish word, alcatraz, which was the word for a pelican. And then finally the word made it into English. I guess this was in the 17th century. And that's when we got the word albatross.
Well, as poorly conceived as that name is, I think penguins might have it even worse. And that's because way back when, sailors actually used to call them arse feet.
That's ridiculous.
I know. And I mean, you can guess why. It's
yeah,
on account
I can
of their
guess why.
Yeah, I mean, it's on account of their short legs and their feet being so close to their backsides. But, you know, thankfully, the Welsh did come up with their own name, penguin, which literally translates as whitehead.
So I like how both these names center on such random characteristics. Like, you know, if I was defining a penguin, the fact that its bum touches his feet, like, that wouldn't be a defining characteristic, you know, or that they have white heads. Like, do penguins even have white heads?
Well, I mean, the whitehead name, it was actually another case of mistaken bird identity, just, you know, just like with the albatross. The Welsh applied the name penguin to their local great auk population. And, you know, an auk being another kind of giant black and white seabird.
Sure.
So the thinking is that some sailors just mistook penguins for auks and the name just stuck.
I mean, I think we've got to make a motion to stop letting sailors name things because they always get it wrong. But
I'm with you. But also, this is kind of random, but have you heard Benedict Cumberbatch try to say the word penguins?
Uh-uh.
Like, for whatever reason, he always winds up calling them penguins or penglings.
What?
And it's just hilarious because he winds up doing all this, like, penguin content. Like, he was in this cartoon penguin movie, and he did the narration for a BBC documentary about penguins. And the whole time, he's just butchering the name. Like, I have no idea how he lands these gigs or why no one corrects him.
That's pretty hilarious. I had no idea, but I'm going to YouTube it right after this episode.
Should. But, you know, since we're on the subject of penguins or penguins, if you prefer, we should really take a few minutes to talk about the largest of their kind, which, of course, are emperor penguins. And these big birds stand around 4 feet tall, which makes them the largest of the 18 penguin species found on Earth. And, you know, also a far cry from the smallest penguin species, and that's the little blue penguin, which is only about 16 inches tall, and that's when it's fully grown.
I love that blue penguins are so little, like they're almost like a pocket penguin. I just want to pick one up and, like, stuff it into my pockets. But let's talk more about these emperors. Like, is it just their size that sets the emperors apart, or are they different from other penguins in other ways as well?
Yeah, well, one difference is that emperor penguins don't do anything the easy way. Like, for instance, other penguins in the southern hemisphere, they make the sensible decision to lay their eggs, you know, during the relatively warm summer months. And that's the same time when Antarctic cruises make their rounds. But emperor penguins, they actually wait until winter arrives to do their mating. And even then, emperors don't head for the warmth of the coasts, you know, to lay their eggs. Instead, they do the opposite and head south into the harshest weather.
That's nuts. And if I've learned anything from March of the Penguins, it's that emperors don't make things any easier on themselves during their incubation periods. Like, I know most penguin species will build nests out of like loose feathers or tiny pebbles and keep their eggs there until they've hatched, but emperor penguins have a different system, right? Like, they incubate their one egg for the entire season, and they do it by standing still and, I think, balancing it on top of their feet.
Yeah, that's right. And this method, it really wouldn't work at all if it weren't for some pretty impressive teamwork on the part of their parents. Like, because as soon as the mother penguin lays her egg, she hightails it toward the sea to feed and build up her fat reserves. So for the next 8 or 9 weeks after that, the task of incubation is left to the emperor dads, who are able to keep their egg warm thanks to this special loose fold of skin that contains a high concentration of blood vessels. And this featherless patch of skin, it kind of drapes over the egg at all times to keep it from freezing. And that's why the father stands still for months on end.
Hmm. I've actually read that male emperor penguins typically burn through nearly half their body weight while waiting for their mates to return. So this is actually one of those rare cases in the animal kingdom where the plumpest and pudgiest males are also the most desirable. I mean, they're, you know, easily the best equipped to survive those long months without a meal.
Yeah, that's true. But, you know, just so people know that we aren't body shaming penguins or anything, I want to mention that emperor penguins, male and female, are actually quite athletic, or, you know, at least they are in the water. In fact, while most aquatic birds would be lucky to dive 200 feet or so underwater, the emperor penguin is capable of diving a stunning 1,500 feet or more. And the amount of time they can stay under is just as impressive. Like, I read the longest dive on record for an emperor is just under 28 minutes.
So that actually is stunning to me. Like, the fact that they can go 1,500 feet under the water, that's incredible. But what is their secret?
Well, it comes down to this amazing trick of physiology. So basically, they can metabolize oxygen at a slower rate during a dive than they would otherwise, like when resting. And this is how Live Science explains it. Quote, the penguins can switch between two modes of oxygen use, either starving their muscles or giving them an extra shot of oxygen to help keep them working. And so emperors, they actually have one other trick up their sleeves as well, which is that their brains have evolved to tolerate extremely low levels of oxygen without shutting down. So not only can these birds control their flow of oxygen, they can survive on a reduced flow for periods of time that would result in brain damage or even death in just about any other animal.
All right, so clearly they're the Olympic divers of the animal kingdom, even if their parenting habits are a little unusual. But now that we've covered everyone's favorite flightless water birds, what do you say we switch gears and talk about some of their land-loving cousins?
Well, I'm down for that. But first, let's take a quick break.
You're listening to Part-Time Genius, and we're talking about the secrets of the world's largest birds. Okay, Gabe, so we've already covered the biggest flyer, a big swimmer, but inch for inch and pound for pound, the planet's tallest and heaviest bird actually does neither of those things. And of course, we're talking about the ostrich here. Now, however awkward they might look, ostriches are actually built for land speed. In fact, they're capable of sprinting up to 43 miles per hour in these short bursts. And that actually makes them the fastest bipedal runners on the planet. But it's not just their speed that's so impressive. Their endurance is absolutely staggering as well. Ostriches are able to maintain speeds of 31 miles per hour for up to 10 miles at a time.
Which is, you know, why you never want to challenge an ostrich to a foot race, right? We all know that old saying.
Yeah.
But, you know, I did some reading on what makes ostriches such great runners, and it turns out the key to their speed is actually their toes.
Really? So why is that?
Well, so most birds have three or four toes on each foot, but ostriches only have two. And while you might think this would hinder the bird's balance in some way, the reduced number of toes actually greatly improves their running form. And as it turns out, two-toed feet result in less mass at the end of each leg, and that's why ostriches can cover up to 16 feet in a single stride.
16 feet in a single stride? That's crazy. But, you know, this whole two-toe thing actually does make sense. I read somewhere that hoofed animals once had more toes than they do now, but gradually over the course of millennia, their toes dwindled down to just two per foot, and they, I guess, became some of the fastest runners in the world as a result of that. But that's really fascinating to me.
Yeah, that is interesting. And, you know, another thing I didn't realize is that people have been racing ostriches, you know, for sport, like the way we race horses. And this has been going on for over 100 years at this point. And weirder still, the practice got its start in Florida. And that's where ostrich race.
Of course it did.
Right, of course. And that's where ostrich racetracks first started popping up. And this was in the late 19th century. Tourists would pay 50 cents to mount these giant birds and attempt to ride them. And, you know, I say attempt because, of course, riding an ostrich is easier said than done, right? Like, they don't take well to training, and it's next to impossible to make them run in a straight line. Not to mention how hard it is to hang on to the back of something that's moving at 40 miles per hour.
You know, there's actually a way around that problem now. There's this annual event at the Meadowlands called the Ostrich Derby. And I've never gone, but it just sounds so great to me. So instead of riding the birds bareback, the jockeys are actually being pulled along in these brightly colored chariots. And the whole thing is completely ridiculous, but it's got its own audience. 2018 was actually the seventh year the races have been held, and you and I should really go to this.
Oh, yeah, we got to get tickets next year. I do want to mention, though, that if you ever come face to face with a wild ostrich, running away is not in your best interest.
Why not?
Well, I mean, there's a good chance the ostrich will give chase. And remember, these things can top out at like 45 miles per hour, so they will catch you.
Right. And male ostriches can grow to be, I think, 9 feet tall and over 300 pounds. So you definitely don't want to be on the receiving end of that. But ostriches are sometimes known to attack humans if they feel their territory is being threatened. But if running is out, like, what is your best bet for surviving an angry ostrich attack?
Well, I looked into that because obviously ostrich attacks are such a common threat that it's really just irresponsible to not be prepared for one. And so this is the advice I found in Discovery News. Instead of running away in terror, they recommend, quote, hiding, playing dead until the bird becomes bored and leaves, or standing your ground and fighting the ostrich off with a long pole.
I like this idea of, like, fighting an ostrich off with a long pole. It makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, right. Just never go anywhere without your ostrich pole and you'll be just fine.
That's good advice. But, you know, before we move on from ostriches, I do want to talk about a couple other ways that these massive birds tip the scales. So for one thing, they have the largest eyes of any land mammal on Earth. Each eye is roughly 2 inches across, which means they're about as big as a billiard ball and even larger than the bird's own brains. Ostriches also have the largest eggs in the world, which I guess an average one comes in at about 6 inches in diameter and weighs more than 3 pounds, which is about as much as 2 dozen chicken eggs.
Good Lord, that is one big omelet. Also, though, like, people do eat them, right? Like, aren't ostrich eggs a delicacy in some places?
Definitely. And a single egg provides quite a meal. I think it's roughly 2,000 calories, so basically a day's worth.
Wow. Well, I know there's at least one more giant bird we wanted to cover today, but if you don't mind, there are a couple misconceptions about ostriches that have always bugged me. So I'd like to take a couple minutes to set the record straight on those. And actually, I want to start with the idea that ostriches bury their heads in the sand.
Sure. So I remember this from Mental Floss, but I remember thinking it was just an illusion, right? Like, ostrich heads are pretty tiny compared to the rest of their bodies. So if you're looking at them at a distance and they're, like, nibbling at food, it just might look like their head's stuck in the ground.
Yeah, that's definitely true. But, you know, actually, some researchers think the real root of the myth has more to do with the nesting habits of ostriches.
Huh.
So the birds, they have to dig some pretty big holes to stow those massive eggs you mentioned. And sometimes these holes are up to 8 feet wide and 2 feet deep. And, you know, it's during the egg incubation period where all the confusion comes in. Like, ostrich parents take turns rotating their eggs with their beaks, which, you know, obviously requires them to stick their heads pretty far into the nest. So, you know, to an observer, it might look like the ostrich is burying its head in the sand, but that's actually not what's going on at all.
That's really fascinating. I never heard that. But do you have, like, another ostrich myth you wanted to share?
Yeah. And this one, it actually goes beyond just ostriches because it concerns the origin of an entire family of flightless birds known as ratites. So along with ostriches, the ratites family also includes other big birds like emus and rheas, as well as tiny flightless birds like kiwis. And for the longest time, researchers have assumed that ratites never had the ability to fly at all. And that's because we know that the wings of these birds are still functional rather than ornamental. So an ostrich, for example, uses its wings like a rudder. Not only are they good for maintaining balance, they also help the birds turn and brake when running at high speeds. So the thinking has been that, you know, since their wings don't seem to be vestigial, ratites probably always lacked the ability to fly. And instead, they simply evolved from other ancient flightless birds.
Which is really interesting, but I think what you're saying is that theory is now being challenged. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, that is right. More recent research suggests that the ancestors of ratites spread to more isolated regions at a time when their wings were still used for flying. And, you know, they likely did this as a way to avoid becoming the lunch of their larger dinosaur cousins. And, you know, then as the dinosaurs died out and the continents began to separate, these now isolated birds found themselves at the top of the food chain and suddenly without the need to escape to higher ground anymore. So once the need for flight was removed, so too was the need to stay small and, you know, in order to be able to fly. And that enabled the birds to independently evolve and become larger as well as flightless.
Which, you know, makes a lot of sense. And it also explains why far-flung islands are home to so many big flightless birds, right? Like New Zealand had this 12-foot-tall, 500-pound moa bird. And that was until humans hunted it to extinction in the 13th century. And Madagascar was also home to this elephant bird. I'd never heard of this bird, but it's amazing. It was an astonishing 10 feet tall and 900 pounds.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I mean, giant birds can thrive in these island settings, partially because there aren't any, you know, predators for them to worry about aside from humans.
Right, exactly. Well, with all that in mind, what do you say we talk a little about another member of the ratite family, one of the world's biggest and most misunderstood birds, the island-dwelling cassowary?
Sure. So this is actually one I've been waiting to talk about. But before we do, let's take another quick break.
All right, Mango, so you said you were excited to talk about cassowaries, just like I am. So would you mind giving us a quick rundown of their stats? Because I somehow feel they're not as well known as ostriches and penguins and all these other birds we've been talking about.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So cassowaries are large flightless birds. They've got black and blue feathers and these big protective frills on the sides of their heads called casques. And there are only three species in the world at this point. Two live in the rainforest of New Guinea off the coast of Australia. And the third and largest one lives in the wet tropics. This is in the northern tip of Australia. You know, birds of this third species are called southern cassowaries, and they typically weigh in around 130 pounds. They stand about 6 feet tall, and they're also fiercely territorial. If you intrude on their habitats, they'll happily slice you up with their terrifying 5-inch-long claws.
Ugh, yeah. Cassowaries are famous for that kind of deadliness, and with good reason, honestly. Like, I was reading this article on Smithsonian.com, and the author, Jacob Brogan, he said that cassowaries resemble, quote, an ostrich as described by H.P. Lovecraft, or maybe a turkey fused with a velociraptor. And I mean, if those descriptions don't sell you on how dangerous these birds are, consider that they're also sometimes nicknamed murder birds.
What?
Yeah. And I mean, not only do they have those razor sharp claws you mentioned, they also have one of the strongest kicks of any animal. And they also have a tendency to charge their victims at up to 30 miles per hour, and then they pounce on them by leaping up to 5 feet in the air.
Oh, that's terrifying. And it also makes me wonder, like, what if they remade the movie Birds with murder birds? Like, that would be so much scarier. But, you know, you mentioned before the break that cassowaries are somewhat misunderstood, and I was hoping you'd clarify that a little bit.
Yeah, well, it's just like with ostriches. You know, cassowaries aren't some kind of malicious human hunters like we might think of them. They're actually shy, peaceful, and pretty harmless when left to themselves. And in fact, a cassowary hasn't killed a human since 1926. And even then, that was only in self-defense. And, you know, while over 100 humans have been injured by cassowaries since then, we've actually done way more damage to them. Like, car accidents and habitat loss, those kinds of things have decimated the southern cassowary population in Australia. And in fact, they're now listed as endangered, and only around 1,500 to 2,000 are thought to be left in the wild at this point. And it really, it could be even fewer than that for all we know.
So one of the things I didn't get to that I was curious about the cassowaries is, how do the locals feel about them? Because on one hand, I'd think the birds would figure into, like, culture and folklore. And on the other hand, people probably don't want these giant dinosaur birds just slicing up their neighbors, right?
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, I'd say it's kind of a rocky relationship at best, but the cassowaries definitely have their supporters. Like, in fact, you'll often see signs along the highways in Australia now that encourage motorists to be cassowary.
Oh.
Good pun, right? And, you know, that's just to, you know, get people to keep an eye out for the birds while they're driving. And as for folklore, cassowaries have always been a big part of the mythologies of Australia's rainforest tribes. For example, some locals believe that cassowaries are cousins to human beings, while others say that they are human beings who have been reincarnated as birds. And actually, this last part there, it's actually even inspired a bit of envy in some of the female locals. Like, they'll joke that they'd like to reincarnate as female cassowaries, since it's the males of that species rather than the females who sit on all the eggs and then raise the chicks that hatch from them.
Well, you know, even apart from the stress-free reincarnation for females, Australians do have another reason to stand up for the cassowary cousins.
Oh, yeah? And what's that?
Well, apparently cassowaries are masters of seed dispersal, which means they're a big part of why Australia still has as much rainforest as it does. And this is something I learned from a Nat Geo article by Olivia Judson, so I just want to go ahead and read her explanation of this relationship. Quote, "As Australia's fruit eaters in chief, cassowaries are also chief architects of the forest. In the course of a day, a single adult cassowary eats hundreds of fruits and berries. Cassowary digestion is gentle, though, and does not harm the seeds, which emerge intact. And so, as a cassowary wanders through its territory, eating, drinking, bathing, and defecating, it moves seeds from one part of the forest to another, sometimes over distances of half a mile or more. It also moves seeds up hills and across rivers. In short, it transports seeds in ways that gravity alone cannot. By means of their fruit-scented droppings, then, cassowaries are a powerful vehicle for spreading seeds around."
That is pretty awesome. Mm-hmm. And you know, now that you mention it, that's something I read about large birds in general, like how the growth or loss of rainforests is directly tied to their presence. I mean, the tallest, hardiest trees, those tend to come from bigger seeds. And without birds big enough to carry or swallow them, the odds of those seeds ever taking root is pretty slim. Hmm. So in a very real way, the future of our rainforests depends on the existence of big weirdo birds like the cassowary.
I like that.
And, you know, in fact, there was this one study done on a particular tree that only grows in a small region of Australia's coastal rainforest, and it went a long way toward showing just how crucial cassowaries are for the tree's survival. And that's because, according to the report, without passing through one of these giant birds, only 4% of these tree seeds ever take root and grow.
Wow.
But after passing through a cassowary, a whopping 92% were shown to grow into adult trees.
I mean, that's remarkable. Like, 92% of the seeds that go through cassowaries end up growing into trees. But why is that exactly?
Well, that's the thing. No one knows exactly. It's still one of the best kept bird secrets out there. And, you know, because I like that idea of going out, you know, with an air of mystery, What do you say we just leave the discussion there and jump straight into the fact off?
I'm for it. Let's do it.
Okay, so I'll go first because I can't bear going through an episode like this without at least mentioning the fastest predator on the planet, the peregrine falcon.
Mm-hmm.
And they have two unbelievable abilities. The first is their eyesight. And I read somewhere that their vision, it's about 12 times that of humans.
Oh, wow.
And they can actually use it to spot a smaller bird from up to 5 miles away. And once this prey is spotted, I mean, it might as well call it quits because peregrine falcons can fly over 180 miles per hour when they hit peak speed. It's crazy. Oh,
that's terrifying. You know, I was at the beach and walking with like a tray of food and fries on it for my kids. And this seagull just swooped down and picked up one fry off the plate. And I just remember being stunned at like how fast it was and how accurate. And the fact that like a falcon can do that at 180 miles per hour is so scary to me. But, you know, we talked about penguins earlier, but I wanted to note that while we think of penguins mainly being at the South Pole, there are definitely a few other spots where you can find them. In fact, the majority of the world's 18 penguin species also live around New Zealand. But the reason I bring this up is because a few years ago, there was this fossil that was discovered on what might be the largest penguin species to ever live. It was probably over 50 million years ago. But the penguin was 6 feet tall and 220 pounds. So even the emperor penguin, which is gigantic, would seem tiny next to this thing.
That's scary to even think about. If you search online for the bird hat craze of the late 1800s, or if you listen to the podcast Dressed, you will realize that this was a really serious fad at some point, these bird hats. Women all over the U.S. and Europe were wearing these hats with feathers and even entire birds propped on top. Like, I was reading an article from Popular Science that talked about how someone reported back after taking two strolls through Manhattan in 1886. And on this stroll, they counted 700 hats. And 525 of them were topped by feathers or just entire birds. So, I mean, the craze, it actually got so big that several bird species became at risk of or even outright endangered. And a campaign to stop the practice launched, and much of this work led to the birth of the earliest Audubon societies, as well as the first federal conservation legislation, which was the Lacey Act of 1900.
So, did you know that one of the ways researchers can take a census of large birds on remote islands is from space? And this is how researchers studying albatross in New Zealand and on islands off the coast of Argentina actually keep a better count of the birds. So it's with a little help from cameras on satellites orbiting the Earth, researchers can actually look at images and count the pixelated white dots to see how many albatrosses are there. And ends up being way cheaper and much less labor intensive than having to travel and count them all in person.
Oh, I bet. Well, you know, they might be able to count birds from space, but one thing they won't be able to do is take birds into space.
Why is that?
Well, it's because birds need gravity to swallow. So unless we come up with another way to assist birds in swallowing, chances are, you know, NASA's not going to be bringing any birds on future shuttle launches, at least not anytime soon.
Well, it just seemed wrong to me to do an episode on big birds and not at least mention Big Bird himself. So, you know, Carol Spinney, who is the voice of Big Bird and Oscar the Grouch. It turns out that if it wasn't for the encouragement of a mentor, he might not have made it past the first year of the show. When Spinney moved to New York City, he didn't have much money. New York City is obviously very expensive, and he didn't feel like he was fitting in with the rest of the cast. So just a few months into the gig, he mentioned this to Kermit Love, who's the man who built Big Bird. And, you know, he said, I might be quitting. And Kermit encouraged him to give it some time. And in fact, he told him, you'll never get an opportunity like this again. It'll get better. Give it another month. And nearly five decades later, I'm pretty sure he's glad he got that advice.
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean, because there's just no way I could beat a Big Bird fact, I think you'll have to take the trophy for today.
Well, I'll take that honor from you, Gabe. So thank you so much. And for all you out there, if we missed any bird facts, be sure to email us at parttimegenius@howstuffworks.com or hit us up on Facebook or Twitter. Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks again for listening. Part-Time Genius is a production of How Stuff Works and wouldn't be possible without several brilliant people who do the important things we couldn't even begin to understand.
Kristen McNeil does the editing thing.
Noel Brown made the theme song and does the mixy-mixy sound thing.
Jerry Rowland does the exec producer thing.
Gabe Luzier is our lead researcher with support from the research army, including Austin Thompson, Nolan Brown, and Lucas Adams.
And Eves Jeffcoat gets the show to your ears. Good job, Eves!
If you like what you heard, we hope you'll subscribe. And if you really, really like what you've heard, maybe you could leave a good review for us.
Did we forget Jason?
Jason who?